The following Dharma talk was given by Danika Shoang Ankele Osho at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoang Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
You know those time-lapse videos that you sometimes see of like a storm moving across a prairie or flowers blooming and then dying? And how those images reveal something true that we can't see ordinarily, because we're just stuck in the frame by frame. And they say that sometimes when you're leaving this body, your life flashes before your eyes. And I was thinking about what a shift of perspective that would be if you saw kind of the time lapse of your life all the way to the end. However that end comes, it's coming. And then what would it be to find yourself here now, having seen that? Just like what is it they say? A flash of lightning in the summer sky, a flickering lantern, a bubble in the stream. So on a liberative path, we kind of have a working understanding or basic assumption that we want liberation. Whatever's going to make the suffering stop, I'll take it. And then I think part of why it's such a long path, maybe, is because as we start to see what that liberation actually involves, or is made of, we're like, I don't know. I'll let go of some of it. I could make a nice long list of all of the things about myself and my life that I'm ready to let go of. It doesn't work like that. And so here we are in the midst of a undoing practice that will leave us totally groundless, and where the truest expression is nothing substantial. And at the same time, bodies and eating and sleeping and shitting, sickness, old age, and death, and no end to sickness, old age, and death. The famed haiku poet Issa wrote, "This world of dew is a world of dew, and yet, I thought this would be a good occasion to, this meaning Rahatsu Sesshin and our observance of the Buddha's enlightenment, a good occasion to touch in on the causes and conditions, in a sense, that brought him to enlightenment. And, you know, I think way too overlooked is Sujata, the young woman from the village. Like, if it weren't for Sujata, we wouldn't be here, because the Buddha would have just passed away. So what did she see that made her bring that rice porridge? Did she just have it with her? And she was like, oh, here's this like very frail, emaciated, close to death sadhu, seeker of the way. Or did she see him and then think, and go home and get the porridge or make the porridge? I don't know. And when she came up to him, did she just say, excuse me? Did she have to persist? Did he come to right away? I don't know. There's a stupa to her, one of the oldest stupas. And then, you know, the story goes that the Buddha confronted Mara, and as Mara was unleashing their sort of tide of strategies to get the Buddha up off his seat, he sat firm and resolutely watching it all without getting drawn in or frightened off. And he touched the earth as his witness, and the earth goddess rose up and wrung out her hair, and a wave of water washed through. And with that, Mara and their host disappeared. And then, of course, implicit in this telling is the mother of all Buddhas, Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. In her book on Indian Buddhist goddesses, Miranda Shaw writes, in the foundational body of Mahayana literature known as the Prajnaparamita, or perfection of wisdom texts, the highest metaphysical principle, the energy, glory, and radiance of enlightened wisdom, is envisioned as a cosmic female, the mother of insight, source of all Buddhas. She is the supreme teacher and eternal font of revelation. All who seek illumination must sit at her feet and drink from the stream of teachings that flow from her presence. To revere her is directly to worship at the source. And I would just like us to take a moment and take in that the personification of enlightened wisdom is given a female form. Hymn to the perfection of wisdom. This is from the Prajnaparamita. The perfection of wisdom gives light. I pay homage to the perfection of wisdom. She is worthy of homage. She is unstained. The entire world cannot stain her. She is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world, she removes darkness, and she leads away from the blinding darkness caused by defilements and wrong views. In her we can find shelter, most excellent are her works. Prajnaparamita, the goddess. Interesting. Interesting that the principle, the enlightened principle, is given in embodied form. So right at the moment where we might get quite heady and abstract, none of the other paramitas have a anthropomorphic figure. It's interesting. And in her book, Miranda Shaw says that as a goddess figure, she arose quite swiftly and suddenly. And despite Shaw's research, she can't really trace, like, how did this come? So I don't know. It's interesting. And, you know, is there something to be made of the fact that it's a female form? I think so. I totally think so. I think it's interesting to think about what that conjures for each of us personally, but certainly the sort of cultural image of a mother, the mother of the Buddhas, you know, is a nurturing image, a life-giving image, a birthing image. So again, with like the coolness sometimes that we might associate with wisdom, we've got this warmth, the mother giving birth. And also, I think, you know, the way that kind of sacred feminine yin energy is often mingled with like mystery, intuition, receptivity. You know, we can think that it's extra to have a personification, that it's kind of a mythic vestige from a tradition that maybe doesn't have so much relevance for us in the present time. And wow, would we be losing out? In her book, Shaw writes about how, she says, some Western thinkers conclude that deities are unreal or non-existent in an absolute sense and don't exist except as human inventions or useful tools for spiritual development. And then she cites the work of Bokhar Rinpoche, a contemporary Tibetan teacher, who says that human envisionments of deities are mental fabrications, yes, that don't correspond precisely to the forms of those deities. So in that sense, he concedes, deities can be said to be a creation of the human psyche. This illusory status, however, holds true only of the human concept and image of a deity, not of the deity themselves. The deities are realities that transcend this world and spontaneously assume various forms to benefit beings. And I was thinking about that. And, you know, what are we talking about when we talk about the perfection of wisdom? And when we see into and begin to see into the teachings on the perfection of wisdom and this insight into the emptiness of all phenomena, don't you kind of get the feeling like you're in the presence of something quite mystical and, dare I say, divine? And so our like puny little human kind of concretizing minds, like, okay, so knowing what we know and feeling what we feel, like give a human form. Okay, so that's limited. That's limited. We're working with what we've got. But if you take it as a pointer, right? You take it as a pointer to something deeper that you can't grasp conceptually. But like, we need a little help so we can like carry on with the journey. And even, you know, Zen doesn't really go that route. There's not a lot about Prajnaparamita as a goddess within like the Zen literature per se. But I was thinking about how often the moon is held up, the mind moon, as a symbol of enlightenment. And like, to me, it's kind of just a hop, skip, and a jump to go from the moon to the goddess of wisdom. Symbols pointing. So one thing that's quite, like, how do we take this and employ it, if you will, for our own practice and journey? In the manifestation of great prajna, a fascicle by Dogen, Dogen is quoting the sutras and uses this anecdote. Indra asked Elder Subhuti, "Great Reverend, if bodhisattvas, great beings, want to experience the profound manifestation of prajna, how should they study?" Subhuti said, "Lord Indra, if bodhisattvas, great beings, want to experience the profound manifestation of prajna, they should study as they would study empty space. Thus, studying prajna is empty space. Empty space is studying prajna." Wang Bo, from the Zen school, said, "This mind itself is Buddha. There is no other Buddha and no other mind. This mind is clear and pure as space, with no appearance at all. When you arouse the mind and stir thoughts, you turn away from the essence of its reality. This is attachment to appearances." Mind clear and pure as space, studying prajna as we would study empty space. Prajna is empty space. Okay, what do we do with that? So the essence of practice is always coming down to one thing. Release your hold. That frame by frame by frame, we're holding the frame. We're creating the frame. We're holding the frame. We're buying into the frame. We're investing in it. We're loving it and hating it. So to release this, releasing fixation, releasing grasping. How much of practice is actually just seeing endlessly, endlessly seeing into our mental formations. Endlessly, endlessly. I think it's ceaseless practice because the mind keeps creating formations, and so we ceaselessly have to practice seeing through. All those formations, what's under? Empty space. What? What does that even mean? Prajnaparamita. Who's that? Is it an idea? No. No. Is it apart from this body? No. No. Is it this body? What are you calling your body? That frame? That's just a frame. Prajna. It's actually pronounced prajna. That's the Sanskrit pronunciation. And pra is before, and jna is knowing. How cool is that? This is a wisdom before knowing. It's not the kind of wisdom we're used to thinking about. That kind of wisdom is a knowing kind of wisdom. Not this kind of wisdom. Studying empty space before knowing. Is it different from this body? You'll never find it any other way. Releasing our grasping, the essence of practice. In a sense, all of the different forms of practice are just giving us different ways to engage with the deep truth of non-fixation. The true essence of reality is right here in the midst of samsara. If we look closely at samsara, we can see that it is nothing more than repeated acts of grasping. When one contemplates the mind that grasps, it is originally pure. What's obscuring this empty space? Don't get me started. Oh man, ideas and opinions, past karma. The kleshas in all their subtle forms, apparent objects. When we start to become familiar with when we start to be able to recognize the quality of mind that's grasping, that's huge. That's like such a big deal. We shouldn't take it for granted. Because that's like a key. And to really study that, we'll find any time that we're suffering, that quality is present. And so there's a way in which that empty space, we actually encounter it right from the beginning in practice, right? Something's bothering you, and there's that like constricted quality of mind, and at a certain point, maybe you recognize it, and who can say how it's done, but you create space, you let go, you stop fighting and let yourself be intimate with your experience. There's lots of ways that we can talk about that, a shift from condensation and claustrophobia into space. And I was listening to a teaching where the teacher said, you know, if something is bothering us, it just means we need more space. Which is interesting, because that's not really a big aspect of Zen training. It's like, if something is bothering you, you've got to make the space inside, right? I mean, how many times does it feel like, you know, for sure for the residents in monastics, but I imagine for anyone who comes here for even a weekend, let alone Rahatsu Sesshin, you think like, oh my God, I just need to like pull out of this. I just need some space. And that's part of our form is like, no, no. So then we have to find where's the space inside, because that's actually also where the claustrophobia is too. And actually, we're coming into contact with our true nature. That's why it's effective. It's why it's been handed down. And it's an interesting point of tension, you know, as we sort of work with accommodations and creating a welcoming environment, how to also preserve that aspect of Zen training, which is uncomfortable and needs to be. Roshi was speaking of this the other day. Coming to the edge of what we think we're okay with, and then recognizing like, oh, there's more space. I have more space. How do we make space? Coming closer. You don't make space by stepping away, interestingly. You make space by coming closer. We say intimacy, being intimate with, being one with. Then there's only space. The closer you get, the more space there is. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, there's a section where Subhuti is talking about non-appropriation. So this tendency, right, the grasping quality of our mind wants to appropriate everything, put it into our framework, call it mine or maybe call it not mine, and kind of start this dualistic relationship. And that's where claustrophobia comes in. Wherever there is duality, trouble is sure to follow. In the Faith Mind poem, there's that section about not to. So this intimacy, this is an inner practice. But we take it up, we can take it up in the world of form. So how to just be with what's there. Close, without getting in the way, without appropriating. Prajna, before knowing, so intimate. We don't need the ideas or the stories. Before the ideas and the stories, there's that mantra, the mantra for the perfection of wisdom. You know the one. Gate, gate, para gate, parasam gate, bodhisvaha. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone beyond, beyond. Hail awakening. So much space. Everything released. Everything released, released. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, Subhuti says, listen and attend well. I will teach you how a bodhisattva should stand in perfect wisdom. Through standing in emptiness, should they stand in perfect wisdom. And then he goes on to speak about what this means, and kind of like the short Heart Sutra, it's a list of things that they should not take their stand upon. So standing, where do we find our ground? What can we rest on? What can we rely on as steady, solid, sure? So Subhuti says, the bodhisattva should develop that they do not take their stand on any of these, not on form, feeling, perception, not on impulses, not on consciousness, not on eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, not on forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, mind objects, not on eye consciousness, etc. Not on the elements, not on earth, water, fire, wind, ether, not on mindfulness, not on right effort. I'm skipping ahead. They should not take their stand on the notion of the fruits of the holy life, or that a stream winner is worthy of gifts, or that a once returner is worthy of gifts. I guess that's a way of saying, like, they're good. It's a good thing to be one. Goes on and on. or that a Pratyeka Buddha is worthy of gifts and will win nirvana after rising above the level of a disciple, that a Buddha is worthy of gifts and will win nirvana in the Buddha nirvana, in the realm of nirvana, etc., etc. Sorry, it's hard to abbreviate this. The language is a little bit dense. A Buddhahood who has stood on the stage of a Buddha and done a Buddha's work, even thereon, a bodhisattva should not take their stand. Okay, so even upon Buddhahood, that was the point. Even upon Buddhahood, you should not take your stand even upon Buddhahood. Thereupon, the Venerable Shariputra thinks to himself, if even there one should not take one stand, then how should one stand and train oneself? And the Venerable Subhuti, through the Buddha's might, was able to read Shariputra's mind and said, what do you think, Shariputra? Where did the Tathagata take their stand? And Shariputra says, nowhere. Nowhere did the Tathagata take stand because his mind sought no support. He stood neither in what is conditioned nor in what is unconditioned, nor did he emerge from them. As the Tathagata is stationed, so will I stand, well placed, because without a place to stand on. So you see, that's how liberation is liberating. Still interested. This world of do is a world of do. And yet. Even if you're like not so sure, I mean, about this whole liberation thing, please remember the deepest motivation for practice. It's not for you, right? I shall attain perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all beings.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.